Hi, everybody. Steve Savitsky, and today we're here with Bracha Goetz. Bracha is a very accomplished author who's written 16 children books, including Aliza in Mitzvahland and What Did You See at Home and The Invisible Book. And she's also the coordinator of the Jewish Big Brothers, Big Sisters program at the Jewish Community Services of Baltimore. How are you? How's everything?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Well, that's good to hear that. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing. It sounds like some pretty interesting things. Tell us a little bit about the Jewish Brothers, Big Brothers and Big Sisters program. What is that?
Well, I run a program here in Baltimore for the Orthodox community. There's another program for the non-Orthodox Jews here, too. And I match up children and teens that need a mentor in their life, a special friend, a good role model. And I have about 60 matches that I supervise, and we're always making more matches, and it's a wonderful program.
So now, how does it work? In other words, you have, first of all, how do you get the referrals of the, how old are the children who need the mentors?
From ages 7 to 17, and they're either from a single-parent family. We match also rebellious teenagers. If there's a severe illness in the family, and if the child has a mild disability, any of those reasons can fit to get a mentor.
Okay, and who recommends the people who need a mentor?
Usually it's the parents that call me. Sometimes it's teachers, sometimes guidance counselors, sometimes therapists, and sometimes it's the children themselves, actually, that call me up.
Really, so they need a mentor. So now if someone becomes a mentor, How often do they meet with? Do they meet with them, or is it on the phone? Where is it? How's it work?
Right, they meet with them at least twice a month. That's what our goal is, and for at least a year, they should do it because we need that stability for them to build trust in a relationship.
Okay, and so where do you find the mentors for the program?
I put ads and blurbs in all the shul and synagogue newsletters. I write articles about how wonderful it is to be a mentor, and I show the results that different, we call them little sisters, little brothers, have written about, or what the parents have written, and how they've grown from the experience. I write articles about that, and just from word of mouth, one friend tells another how great it is to be a big brother, big sister. We also provide we provide passes to go to different places in the community that they enjoy, and it's a really great experience for everybody, for the bigs as well. They really grow from it.
And why don't you tell us about maybe one or two experiences that you've seen that, you know, our listening audience would like to know about?
Well, one experience is a girl who lost her father, and she loved having her big sister. For years, they were just amazing. She helped her tremendously to gain back her confidence in life. And later on, this girl, during the time that I've been doing this, she became a big sister when she was old enough, which is really beautiful to see that she wanted to give to another girl. And so I matched her also with a girl whose father was not in her life any longer. And it's been beautiful. So you just see how this gets passed on one from the other.
And do you have a set, like, I'm not saying curriculum, but do you have a set goals that you want to accomplish, or do you just let it kind of flow?
In general, like, we want to see, we call it the three C's, competence, caring. What was the third C? Competence?
I'm glad you're not asking me for that, okay?
Right, okay. Anyway, we look for certain improvements in people. We ask about it at the end of the year, have they seen different types of growth. But it's a pretty loose program in terms of the main thing is to focus on strengths. When the bigs are not there to focus on the problems in the child's life or the teen's life, but to build on their strengths. So it's a program of promoting joy. That's really how I see it, just adding more joy to the world and letting the neshama shine out that's in the child or teen. That's really what we're looking for.
Do you ever have, let's say, a gathering where they all get together, or is this really on a one-on-one basis, more or less?
Yeah, great question. Sometimes we have, a few times a year, we have group activities where people come together. We have a bowling event. We have a pizza event. We've gone on trips, like hiking trips and things like that, picnics, all different types of things that we arrange. And we also have trainings for the bigs to learn more about different things like how to build confidence when you're little. They learn about learning disabilities, different types of things that they're asking us to learn more about.
So the big brothers or big sisters, they range in age from what?
They range in age from senior in high school all the way to actual seniors.
Really?
Yeah, elderly people. And the only people we discourage from becoming bigs are those with young children themselves, because sometimes people actually come and they want to volunteer, but we say, no, just stick with your own family. So
take care of your own kids first and then worry
about
everybody else. So
exactly.
you might have a senior dealing with somebody who's a teenager that, you know, maybe is having some problems. How does that work? Is there like the generation gap? It's kind of hard, isn't it?
Yes, it could be hard, except that the people that volunteer are so exceptional. We have one man, he's a senior, he's approaching 70 now, and he's been doing this almost as long as I've been doing this, for 12 years, and he's had several different teens. He works especially well with teens. I give him the very hard ones, because when boys have been thrown out of all different schools, the teens, they're very rebellious. He meets them exactly where they are, and he focuses on whatever strengths he sees and makes them feel wonderful about themselves. So, like one of them, that one teen he had years ago, who was doing terribly in school, this man, the big brother, is an architect. He got the little brother interested. He had an interest in art, and he got really interested in architecture. This guy who was failing in school ended up doing beautifully, went to architecture school, and is now working for the same firm,
that he was working for. That's a great thing. Now, you mentioned that you've been doing this for 12 years. How did you get involved in this?
Okay, great question. So I was working with the elderly, actually, before this. I was a director of activities for a large residence. And then I saw this ad that they were looking for someone to coordinate the program, helping to create a program for the Orthodox youth, especially that were going off the derech. It was really increasing at that time. This was about 12 years ago, where there were a lot of teens suddenly being seen on the streets, hanging out. All of this was increasing a lot. Now, I'm a Baal Tshuva, and for me, it was a tremendous struggle to become Orthodox. And so I've always been fascinated. I've been fascinated since this phenomenon has been happening of why people go off the derech when I work so hard to get on the derech, you know.
Right, good question. That's great, yeah.
Yeah, and this was something that's very dear to us, to me and to my husband. We're both Baalei Tshuva, and we're very into care, very into having people over. And with our children also, we would discuss the most basic issues about Judaism. And so this is what I was hoping to do here. My goal was to understand why would people go off the derech, and what could I do to help them, you know, get
so
back into...
Since you brought it up, okay, tell me why. What do you think the main reasons are why people go off the path? Okay, what's the reason?
Okay, well, I want to say that the main reason is a lack of joy. And there has to be a tremendous amount of joy in Yiddishkeit. Sometimes if people go off the derech, it's because people that have been helping them, you know, older people, they've been learning from possibly are not exactly on the derech themselves either. In a sense, they're still doing the mitzvahs, but they've lost an inner joy and an understanding of why they're doing them. So...
Mm-hmm. And this is one of the major areas, by the way, that you know that we've been concentrating on a lot and been thinking about a lot at the Orthodox Union and trying to come up with programs to restore the joy, bring it back into being a Orthodox Jew, because we also feel that maybe there's something lacking. So what do you think we have to do to restore the joy?
Well, okay, one of the other, you know, initiatives that I got involved with, I wrote the Let's Stay Safe book.
About the kids to read the book about, right, I read the book, it's very, very terrific.
Right. To keep children safe, this is so important, and it was found to be a major cause of people going off the derech also. People, like when you go in where, I work a lot with people in recovery, people with recovering from addictions to drugs. And so if you see those using hardcore drugs, if they came from an Orthodox background, I don't think you can find any of them that don't have abuse in their background.
Really?
So it's really essential. And thank God, since this book is out, it has now become a mainstream thing that that parents are teaching their children about prevention education. This is so essential. And of course, if anybody has suffered from abuse, that wipes out the joy in their life. So that's a major reason.
And you think that this is a very high proportion compared to the general population, or where does it rank?
I don't have the statistics because I don't think that the research has been done yet to really compare how it is in our population versus the regular population, but it's probably somewhat comparable. I don't think it's more or less. We have certain factors that make it be less, but then we actually have certain factors that can increase it, and that's that we haven't been educating our children until now. Thank God it's now being discussed. And parents, I think this book has made a really big impact. I'm so grateful.
Yeah, it's great. No, the book is great. What do you think about this issue, by the way, about, reporting, this whole big controversy about reporting abuse to the authorities as opposed to reporting it to the rabbinic authorities who will then report it to the police authorities? I mean, that's a whole big issue, right?
Exactly. And I wrote an article about this, and I'm not sure it got enough. If people really understood what I was trying to say here, because this is an extremely important point. The issue is reglaim ledover, and that's what the Aguda was saying, that people, that it can only be reported directly to the police if there's reglaim ledover. But so that's the thing. Anybody, as Rav Eliashiv said, if there's circumstantial evidence, knowledge that abuse took place, it needs to be reported directly to the authorities. And that's where the confusion lies. So if anybody has first-hand information, in other words, if a person is a victim of abuse, that means they had first-hand information, they need to go directly to the police. Anybody that does not have first-hand information needs to go to a rabbinical authority and check out if there's anything they need to report to the police, because they may not have enough circumstantial evidence. But victims themselves, I think that's the part that hasn't been made clear enough.
So victims or people who are familiar with the victims, knowing that they've heard it from the victim.
Well, if it's a person familiar with the victim, they may not have first-hand information. You need actually to have evidence. So if it's a child, then the parent, of course, needs to accompany the child to make a report. But the child has the first-hand evidence that's needed. And so that's why I think it's important for people to realize that any victim of abuse has the evidence needed to make a report. And people with secondhand information would need to first speak with a rav to determine if the information that they have is enough evidence that needs to be reported.
Okay. And you agree with that position?
Well, that's the important distinction that needs to be made. All victims need to report to the police. They don't need to go to a rabbi first because they have the evidence.
Right.
They've experienced it. They've seen it firsthand. And that's what makes it different. And that's what Rav Eliashiv was explaining. And I don't think that's been made clear enough, that victims need to go to the police. It's only people with secondhand information that would first need to get.
In other words, let's say you're a teacher in a school. And, you see a kid who, you speak to the kid, you see that the kid has bruise marks, this and that, and so on. What are you supposed to do?
Right. Well, you do as minimal amount as possible, because lay people don't know the investigative techniques necessary to make determinations. So if you see something like that, it needs to be reported to civil authorities that could do the expert investigations that need to be done.
Okay. Let's go back to your program for a minute. So who actually funds your program?
It's funded by the Associate, which is the Federation. In all other cities, it's called Federation. Here, it's called the Associated.
Okay. Right. So the Associated funds it, and they fund it for all different streams, so the Conservative, Reform, and Orthodox, or just...
Exactly. It's really beautiful. Baltimore is very famous for really getting support from the Associate for all streams of Judaism, which is very beautiful.
And so the program runs. And how about the other two streams? Are they as they have as many people as you do, or how does it work?
They actually don't. They have about half the amount of matches that I have. And I would just say that it's because there's no stigma about this program whatsoever. You know, I think it's gotten a very good reputation in the community, so it's really, you know, growing, and people are very excited to get Big Brothers and Big Sisters. There's no stigma
right.
about
that. No, it sounds like a good... Now, is there a possibility that this program will go to other cities and, you know, and being funded by Federation or other places? Or is it really kind of limited to Baltimore?
Right. I've had calls from different cities and other... In other cities, they've modeled it after this program, thank God, and it should continue. And also, there's the Project Yes program. I think that's also a similar type of program that is, I think, only for Orthodox children that Rabbi Horowitz is involved with. Yeah.
Right, right. As a matter of fact, we're gonna be interviewing Rabbi Horowitz also and to talk to him about this. And now, so you've written a lot of books, and 16 altogether.
Thank God.
Wow. First of all, they said, so you went to Harvard, is that true?
Yes, right.
Wow, that's really impressive. That's great. So now, how did you get into writing children's books?
Okay, let's see. I've been writing since I was a child, that's for sure. Always writing poetry when I was little. And let's see, my story is that I was going to medical school after Harvard, and I had 6-week vacation. And my parents thought of the idea, since I was only dating non-Jews, that I should date someone Jewish. So they had the idea of I got a volunteer position on the oncology department at Hadassah Hospital for the summer. And when I went there, basically, I remember my mother saying to me, you know, do whatever you want in Israel. Just don't contact this one guy I knew from my childhood who became a religious fanatic. So right away, I got in touch with him. You know, I mean, I had still a way I could be rebellious. So I got in touch with him. He was at Esher Torah, and he took me to Neve and Or Sameach. Or Sameach had a small women's division then. And from the minute I walked in, I was like, oh, my goodness, this is what I've always wanted to learn about Judaism. So I was fascinated. I had never really learned that Judaism could be so spiritual and interesting and that basically research that was being done at Harvard, I found out the information was already in the Torah. You know, those are the things I was learning. So it was a really great experience for me. And I soon met my husband, who was also a Baal Teshuva. And after I got married and started having children, I started writing books. And so I was writing books for my children and writing for them. And then now that time has passed, I continue to write for my grandchildren. And as I have more and more grandchildren, I thank God more and more books are coming out.
That's great. So. Well, that's really fantastic. Look, you sound like you're an incredible, incredible person, and you're doing great things. Your program sounds phenomenal, and I really sincerely appreciate you coming on the program to educate our listeners as to what you're doing. And we want to wish you the very best of luck. So thank you so much for being on the program and continue to write all those books, not just for your grandchildren, but for everybody in the Jewish community. Thank you so much, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.